This is Evolutionary Radio. This is your host, Trevor Caritzen. Joining me, as always, we got Steve Smee.
Hey, what's up, guys? Happy Halloween for everyone out there.
We got a very exciting episode. It is Halloween. Mike, thank you for joining us on Halloween. Mike Arnold is today's guest. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What you guys didn't see is before we started recording, there's quite a bit of technical difficulties. Mike, I'm amazed that you've never used Skype. Like, really? You've never used Skype before?
I have not set it up. I've used it a couple of times, but basically all I had to do was call somebody with my cell phone, and they did the rest of the work. So, no, I'm not too familiar with it. I know I'm a little bit behind the times on that, pretty much with all this technology that's been coming out. I just haven't kept up on it over the last 10 years or so.
I know you, I need kinda, to deal with it, but. You remind me a lot, Mike, of a lot of my professors. I'm in academia. I'm a graduate student. And a lot of my professors, like, they still have flip phones and, like, they know nothing about technology, but they're absolute geniuses, right? And technology is just something that doesn't interest them, right? And that's kind of what you remind me of, is, like, you're such a wealth of information, but you're kind of behind the times when it comes to technology. It's kind of just like, I can just see, like, your passion about information, your passion about steroids and SARMs and all these sorts of things. And you're like, ah, technology, I don't care. It doesn't interest me.
Yeah, I just really don't have too much interest in it. I know I see everybody buying all these new expensive phones. And I mean, my daughter, who, you know, she's just young, she's 13, and she knows, I mean, she's known more than me about this stuff since she was probably 9 or 10 years old. And yeah, I just don't care about it.
At least the millennial generation, they're good for something, you know, they can help you out with that. I still have an iPhone 4 and people make fun of me. I got a little iPhone 4. So I think we're up to like an iPhone 8 now.
You have an iPhone 4, Steve? That's like the dinosaurs used.
Yeah, I had a flip phone before that, so it works fine for me. I'm gonna stick to it. All right.
Oh, geez, I'm recording with two old men.
Yeah.
So the reason we want to get Mike on the show is Boston Lloyd has been on the show as a guest multiple times. Boston Lloyd is a good friend of both mine and Steve's, and you got Ariella pregnant. So first off, congratulations, Boston. I don't think we've said that on the show yet. So Boston Lloyd got Ariella pregnant. Everything's looking good. It's a healthy pregnancy. So congratulations to them. The most amazing thing is that Boston got Ariella pregnant while on cycle. He didn't come off. So basically Boston hired Mike. Mike gave him a baby making protocol that obviously worked. And, you know, when Boston got Ariella pregnant, he basically emailed me telling me the good news. I said, you got her pregnant while you were on test? Like, how the heck did you do that? And he's like, well, Mike Arnold gave me this baby-making protocol. So I was like, give me Mike's email. Let's get him on the show. This is going to be a great episode because so many people on cycle are trying to get their wives pregnant with no luck. So, Mike, the floor is yours. Basically, what did you tell Boston to do?
Yeah, going back to one thing you were saying a second ago about, you know, getting pregnant on cycle, I think there's a bit of a misconception out there regarding people having to come completely off. It really just something you may have to. It just depends how you're going to approach it. You know, if you're going to approach it from, well, I want my own pituitary cranking out its own FSH and LH, and I want to do it, you know, to have your body, the entire HPTA working, then you would have to come off completely, you know, because anything like AAS or even SARMs would basically shut down your hypothalamus from signaling the pituitary, so you wouldn't be producing any FSH or LH. So if somebody wants to take that route, like the Clomid route, which, you know, is, you know, people have been doing that for decades. It can be very effective, but when you have guys that either, they're so shut down that even with off time and a bunch of Clomid use, sometimes it can take a very long time for that to work. And it's certainly not going to work if you're still on. People have heard of HCG, which has been around for many years now. Bodybuilders have been using it for a long time. And one of the newer drugs that's come around, it's still been around for quite a few years, but it's starting to get more popular, in recent years, it would be HMG. And you don't need to go off cycle. The amount of gear you're taking really is irrelevant. And the reason for that is HCG, which most people are familiar with, really just mimics LH. Well, when you take, if you were to inject HCG or just LH, if you had LH by itself, it bypasses your pituitary. So you really don't need to turn that back on. So when people use things like HCG and HMG, you're still actually technically shut down, at least at the level of the pituitary. So that hormone, HCG, just travels right to the testes and it mimics LH in the body. So it basically signals the testes to produce testosterone, just like your own pituitary's LH would do. So it doesn't matter if you're taking AAS or the quantity of AAS you're taking, the HCG will still do its job. That's why a lot of people use HCG on cycle, throughout their cycles, so they don't lose testicular size. And it also makes it easier to recover when people do go off if they decide to go through a PCT. But the second piece of the puzzle here would be, and what's really more important for fertility, would be HMG. I mean, HCG is great if somebody just wants to maintain or regain testosterone production, but it's not, LH, the hormone it mimics, isn't really the hormone that's used to stimulate sperm production. That would be FSH, or follicle-stimulating hormone. Now, the cool thing about HMG is it's actually a combination of two different hormones. It's actually real luteinizing hormone, or LH, and FSH in the same suspension. So you're getting an equal quantity of each. So when you inject something like HMG, actual LH goes right to the testes, and so does SFH goes right there too as well. So they're, you're signaling your body to produce both testosterone and sperm at the same time. So once again, you don't have to worry about any drugs you may or may not be using. And it's an easier way also for guys, to most people, to get pregnant, because you really only have to worry about testicular recovery. You don't have to worry about pituitary recovery, and that's where a lot of guys get have problems. Even if their testes could work, if your pituitary isn't producing enough LH and FSH, it's not going to really matter if your testicles have the ability to function or not. You're not going to be able to produce any just because there's the hormone signal isn't there, or it's not strong enough.
I just want to be clear for the people listening. Boston Lloyd was on tons of gear for a long period of time, correct?
Right.
So he never cared about recovering his HPTA, and he probably never will be able to, correct?
It would be difficult. I would actually say that most people, there's some people more resilient than others, but I would say most guys, once they go the steroid route, very few of them probably ever regain full functioning. I mean, you'll have your anomaly here and there, but, most people can regain to a degree. But say you started out, you had an 800 testosterone level before you ever touched a drug on average. You run steroids for a couple of years, even a year, even 6 months. It's doubtful that you're ever going to go back to producing that level of testosterone again, without any assistance, if you decided to quit steroids. And then that's assuming you use PCT. Your body probably just won't continue to produce the same amount. And for guys that are on for a long period of time, 5 years, 10 years, even if they take breaks here and there, there's just so much suppression going on for so long that most of these guys are going to end up on TRT. It's just going to be the rare person that's going to be able to do something like that and can bounce back and still produce a decent level or an acceptable level of testosterone. So
this protocol basically is not for someone who cycles on and off steroids, who's trying to get their wife or girlfriend pregnant. This is for someone, this is kind of an extreme protocol, like you said, where you're mimicking LH and you're skipping over to pituitary gland functioning. So is that correct? So someone listening to this should just basically, who has a healthy HPTA, should just come off steroids and try to recover their HPTA correctly versus doing this extreme protocol. I just want to be clear, because most of our listeners cycle steroids on and off in a healthy way versus like, you know,
Well, you can do it that way. It's really, when I talk to people about it, I usually present them with both options. Usually the faster option is just to use HCG and HMG. But, you know, like you said, if somebody, I guess it depends what the individual wants. If they want to be able to fully recover their HPTA, they want to retain that functioning on their own, then yes, the only way you're going to be able to get there, you're going to have to go off all AAS, and you're going to have to go through, you know, Clomid or Novadex, you know, and AI, not necessarily all of them, but, you know, the common PCT drugs that people use and attempt to regain functioning. That will take longer. Does that mean that somebody that does cycle the steroids can't use the other one? No, anybody can still use it if they want to. I've had people that have tried to, you know, you go the Clomid route for a while, and it just wasn't working. You know, 6 months later, 9 months later, 10 months later, you know, a year later, you know, they haven't had success in impregnating their wives, and they've switched over and then had success within a relatively short period of time.
Okay. So
it's not, it's not that.
So go ahead with the protocol that you, if you want to share the protocol that worked for Boston Lloyd, for someone who's been abusing steroids for a long period of time, what was the protocol? It was HMG with Clomid?
Yeah, it was, well, he was using, yes, it's nothing, it's actually, a lot of people have actually employed the protocols like this or very similar to this, and you'll see them out there. One difference that might you might see between this one and some of the other ones is it's a bit of a higher in HCG dosage. Now, this isn't something I would recommend somebody do long-term just because of potential desensitization issues. But depending on the individual, it's not always the same. But I believe, I don't remember exactly what Boston's HCG dose was, but it was fairly high. It was a few thousand IU. Normally what I'll have people do is I'll run, have them use HCG three times a week, say a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday protocol, and it could go range anywhere from 1,000 up to 3,000, 4,000. In some cases, I've had guys run 5,000 that in each inject. Now that might seem like a very large dose, and it is a large dose, but it isn't something I would continue with for a long period of time. It would be more short term. And then the HMG is generally one vial, which is a 75 IU vial, 75 IU of both LH and FSH. And then that would be on alternate days. So say Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. And that's really all you need to take when you're doing, at least the male, when you're trying to regain fertility. Without the HMG, you're going to have a much more difficult time, because even though HCG mimics LH and LH is found in HCG, for reasons that I'm not even sure if anybody understands why, I've tried to do some research on it and look around as to why HCG would even be necessary or helpful, but it does tend to be helpful. A sperm count tends to recover more quickly when both are used together, so you'll find more people recommending them used together. If you want to increase your chances even more of impregnation, you would have the woman use something like Clomid. Now, there is a risk of twins, and most people are aware of that. It's not a really high risk, but it does go up to, from the statistics I've seen, it goes from about 1%, 1.5% from somebody that doesn't use Clomid to about 1 in 20, so about 5%. So it does go up considerably, but it's still fairly low. You know, if the chances of having more than twins, like triplets, that's like 1% or less. But people need to be aware of that, because if somebody really doesn't want to be caring for, you know, multiple kids at one time, then it is something to think about. But it will increase the chances more, because if the woman drops more eggs, you know, there's going to be a greater chance of fertilizing one of those eggs versus there being just one. So if you attack it from both angles, you'll increase your chances of pregnancy to a greater degree. But that's a decision a couple would need to come to, you know, on their own, whether or not they want to employ Clomid in the woman's case.
Trevor, do you have any other questions on that before we move on to another topic?
Well, what I was going to ask is, you know, HMG, this is something I've heard about. It's fairly new. It's not something I've done a ton of research on. The problem with peptides, and I'm sure you know this, Mike, is that it's so hard to find a good source. You know, the market is full of fakes. Where would someone find this HMG? Can you get it?
It's not a peptide, Trevor. It's a hormone just like HCG. It's not a peptide.
Okay, anyways, this hormone, where could you get it? Can you get it prescribed by your doctor? If you went to like a fertility clinic, would they be able to prescribe it for you, or would you need to use like an
undergraduate? Yeah, you can. It depends on the doctor, really. I've talked to some people, some clients. They've come back and said, "Mike, my doctor won't give it to me," you know. And then others said, "Yeah, it's not a problem." Obviously, if somebody can go to their doctor and the doctor can give them a prescription for it, especially if you have insurance, that's the way to go. Clearly, you pay hardly anything. You know what you're getting is legitimate. You're doing everything legally. So sure, try that way first. That would be what I would recommend. If not, you know, there's a variety of places, online pharmacies all over the place that can sell it to you. I'm sure there's plenty of fakes out there and things that are junk or crap or don't even have HMG in it at all. But, you know, if you look around and what sources are good, and I'm not going to start listing sources or anything like that, but, you know, you might be some good sources for a while and then they might, you know, fall off and they're not there. And then you need to go look around for some other ones, but it's not as commonly used as something like HCG. So, you know, it's going to be, you know, it's not going to be as easy to find, but if somebody wants it, it's fairly easy to find it out there. And there are lots of, like I said, online pharmacies sell it. A few peptide companies are starting to pick it up and sell it now, but most peptide companies aren't yet at this point. But yeah, it's out there. It's not something like AAS where, you know, you really need to be concerned with the legality issues. You know, I haven't seen, you know, the DEA be that concerned with, you know, importing HMG yet at this point. So it is a bit easier to find than some other things.
So another question I have for you is, I'm on doctor-prescribed testosterone replacement therapy. Those who have listened to the show for a while know basically I started steroids when I was 18. I permanently shut down my HPTA. Now I'm on doctor-prescribed mm-hmm. TRT. I'm fairly young to be on mm-hmm. TRT, but before getting on TRT, basically the deal the endocrinologist made with me is I want you to go to sperm bank, donate a sample, have it frozen, because then, you know, later on in life, if you want to have kids, you always have that option because, you know, getting on TRT at a very young age increases your chance for infertility. Based on right. your research, Mark, how confident are you that you could get, you know, pretty much anyone could pretty much get their wife pregnant using this protocol? Or did Boston just kind of luck out? Like what I'm asking is, like, Boston's situation, was that kind of, you know, the norm, or did Boston just get really lucky?
Well, I don't think is necessarily the norm, you know, because Ariella got pregnant really quick. I think he said, 2 weeks? Now, it does take sperm, you know, 2.5-3 months to fully mature. So what was likely happening in Boston's case is he was already on his way towards, you know, having some sperm that were becoming fully mature. And when he started the program, it like just enhanced the process, and then she got pregnant. So I've seen a number of people that have gotten, you know, impregnated their wives within 2 months. Most of these individuals had already been trying some various other protocols for fertility before I even spoke with them. So they were likely, you know, they were starting to get on the right track already. So then once they started this protocol, it was enough to, you know, boost them forward enough to get their wives pregnant. But as far as anybody, you know, I would never make the claim and say, oh, this is going to work for everybody, or it's going to work within this amount of time, because you never really know what issues somebody might have. And as I mentioned earlier, although we were referring to testosterone production, you never really know how resilient somebody is. There are a lot of people out there that do struggle with fertility, and there are also a lot of people that don't. And I think that's a part of the reason for the misconception, because we see, we've all heard stories of people that don't take any fertility drugs. They're loaded up on gear, and their wife's pregnant, and they end up having kids. You know, some of these guys have 2, 3, 4, 5 kids, and they've never been off gear. And then you have the other guy, doesn't take that much, didn't even take it for that long, and he gets off and he's trying like crazy, doing everything he knows he can do to try to regain fertility, and it's been a year, you know, and his spouse still isn't pregnant. So, but I would tell you this, the people that try to just go the Clomid route to try to like have their HPT get fully back in line and functioning how it was before, or good enough to restore sperm count to a healthy level, I would say the percentage is probably lower doing that, or it's going to take longer, because you have to regain functioning of the entire HPTA, and it does take longer. But the people that are going to, you know, use HCG and HMG, so far from what I've seen, I don't know anybody yet that has not been able to get their wife pregnant. Many of these people have been using steroids for many years and yet were successful. I have seen and spoken with some individuals that took some time, but nobody yet that I know of that said, hey, it's been like 4 years and my wife's still not pregnant. I haven't encountered that yet. So I think it is pretty successful.
I think a sperm test would at least give you a realistic idea, right, Mike? Like if people are sitting, I'm sorry?
No, go ahead, continue.
No, I was gonna say, if you're sitting right now listening to this and you're like, wow, I wonder, you know, what my sperm count, how healthy, you know, my sperm count is, shouldn't people go get a sperm test? Wouldn't that be an accurate measure? And if your sperm count were, you know, low, then at least you know, hey, I have a less chance. Did Boston get a sperm count? Do you know if he had a pre and during sperm count?
I do not know if he did or not. I don't recall if he had mentioned it to me at the time. So I can't answer that question as far as whether he did or not. But yes, obviously, if somebody is trying to have success in impregnating their spouse, they're going to want to see how they're doing. You got to go in and you got to get your sperm count tested, test for motility, all that. See where you stand. Not only going to tell you if the if you're having success, but it's going to tell you if you need to move on to something else. Because you know you don't want to sit here and waste your time. You know, if you're you're using one protocol and it's not working for you, you know, you went 8 months into it and your sperm count still sucks, your motility still sucks. You know, maybe at that point you might say, maybe it's time to try something else. So you need to do that to be able to gauge what if you need to move on or continue with what you're doing. And also as well, you know, the wife should be getting looked at too to see if, you know, there's any issues on her end. It's not always the man. You know, sometimes it could be the woman. She may not be dropping it. She could have other issues, especially with a lot of bodybuilders are dating or married to, you know, women in the fitness industry. A lot of times when their body fat gets too low, you know, they stop getting their periods or they stop dropping in. So, you know, you could, you need to look at that as well, taking the whole picture.
So that was going to be my next question for you, Mike. Now, I know Ariella only used Clomid for a couple of weeks, but could a female experience any side effects, any possible long-term side effects from long-term Clomid use? Because I know these are anti-estrogen drugs.
Right. Yeah. So, women and men can both experience side effects. Women actually would not use Clomid in the same way men do. You know, when a man uses Clomid for PCT, fertility, whatever, he generally stays on, you know, 50, 200 milligrams, and he'll stay on it for an extended period of time, months, you know, usually at least, even longer in some cases until, you know, pregnancy is achieved or he's made a full recovery in his PCT. Women don't use it the same way. So I'm actually glad you brought that up, because the last thing I'd want to see is, some woman, you know, saying, oh, well, let's increase our chances even more and I'm going to jump on Clomid and I'm going to take 100 milligrams for the next 6 months. No, don't do that. They should only be taking it for a few days. You know, general recommendations would be start 3 days into your cycle through day seven. So, you know, 5 days of Clomid use, you know, 50 milligrams. If she's still not dropping eggs after that, you could go up to 100. But generally, if the woman is under 38 years of age, you know, you could do like about 6 Clomid runs. And then the medical, according to medical research or the medical community, they will recommend if you have not achieved success after 6 Clomid runs, then just stop. If you're over 38 years of age, 3, and limit it to that, because there are a variety of side effects. I'm not familiar with all of them. I was reading down a list, but there can be some pretty serious side effects if it's abused, and that's why it's the doctors will tell women to limit it to only a certain amount of runs and then call it a day. So you really need to plan it. If a woman's going to use it, I would recommend she not get on it until the man has been on HCG and HMG for a few months, especially if he hasn't been doing anything prior to regaining fertility, because you want to make sure that his sperm count is high enough and he's regained his motility so that when she's using Clomid, there is a chance of her getting pregnant rather than her just using Clomid when the man is still, you know, not producing enough sperm because he just started using HMG and HCG, you know, 10 days prior. So wait until he's got, you know, some recovery in there and has the ability to impregnate, and then she can go on Clomid and if she wants to. And, you know, like I said, limit it to 6 runs under 38 years of age, 3 runs over 38 years of age.
Got you. So that makes a lot of sense. You know, use the Clomid as a last resort because it'll also increase the chance of getting, you know, twins and triplets. I got one more follow-up question for you, Mike, and then we're going to take the show on a little bit of a segue. So Boston was very stubborn, right? Obviously, he didn't want to get off gear. Let's say you had a client who was his goal is getting his wife pregnant. He doesn't care about staying on cycle or anything like that. Would best case situation be, you know, get off all steroids, use the HCG, use the HMG and try to get your wife pregnant? Or does it not really matter? Is it like, will being on gear not really affect your chances of getting your wife pregnant?
You're talking about when using HMG and HCG?
Correct.
Yeah, gear doesn't really matter.
Does it matter if or not they're on gear?
No, it doesn't really matter. Because like I was saying earlier, you're bypassing. It's literally like you, in a sense, would be forcing your pituitary to produce the correct hormones. But rather than doing that, you're just taking those hormones and you're putting them directly into your bloodstream. So you don't have to, your body doesn't have to be sent any signals to produce those hormones. You're injecting them right in there. They're going right to the testes and they're signaling them saying, produce sperm, produce testosterone. So it doesn't really matter if you're on gear or not. It's going to work. If it's going to work, it's going to work regardless. So there's not really a need to have to go off just to try to increase your chances. But one thing I've seen a lot of people doing that... Go ahead.
No, I finish up and then I'll say something.
Oh, I was just going to say one thing I've seen in some programs out there that doesn't make sense to me. So I would like to, you know, maybe speak with some of the people and see where their what logic is behind this. But I see people recommending HCG, HMG, and Clomid, not for the woman, but for the man altogether. And I've seen several out there like this. And I have to wonder what the point of using something like Clomid is with HCG and HMG. I can understand a PCT where you use something like HCG or HMG in the beginning to kickstart a testicular production of those hormones, but then you go off those drugs and then you switch over to something like Clomid to try to, you know, the only real reason to use something like HCG or HMG on a PCT is really just so that once your pituitary starts cranking out LH and FSH on its own through like Clomid, Nova, or an aromatase inhibitor would be so that the testes don't really have to catch up in size. They're kind of already in a functioning state so they can produce sperm and testosterone more quickly. But you don't want to run something like that all the way through your PCT. You're going to essentially keep yourself shut down because they are suppressive to the pituitary. So when I see people running Clomid with their fertility programs while they're using HMG and HCG, it just doesn't make any sense. It seems to be a useless addition, which really you're just going to give yourself, if you're prone to side effects from Clomid, more side effects for zero benefit. So I definitely wouldn't recommend people do that.
Mike, what I was going to say is all of the guys listening to our show, after you said that, you know, being on cycle isn't going to affect your results by running your protocol, I'm sure they're all just like going, yes, see, I told you I didn't have to get off cycle. Because like, let's face it, if you're on TRT, no one really wants to get off. So that was very informative. We're 30 minutes into our show, which is perfect because I wanted to basically break the show into two segments. So the first segment was the baby making protocol. The second segment is enotropics. So these are fairly new to market. Basically, enotropics are something that enhance cognitive function, enhance focus, but aren't stimulants. So the beauty of something like that is that you could take them, you know, late at night. They're not going to raise cortisol levels. They're not going to affect sleep, things like that. So Mike, before we get into all the different types of enotropics, can you kind of just explain to us what exactly they are, how they work? And then a big question I have for you is, what's the legality of them? Is this something that, you know, you kind of have to, is this like that gray area of supplementation, like SARMs and peptides, or are these perfectly legal? Because I'm in Canada, so I'm wondering, could I even buy enotropics that are being sold in the US and import them across the border? Or is it something like steroids and they're completely illegal and you have to use an underground lab?
Yeah, good questions. Well, the first question regarding, you know, how they work, what they are and how they work, that is a very in-depth question because, well, first of all, the entire class of drugs, if you just combine them all together, it's kind of almost become a blurred general term now to describe a lot of different compounds that wouldn't necessarily fall into that class as it was originally defined. But today, you're finding a lot of compounds that are being lumped in together with that. And it's really, I can't say that's right or wrong, because it really was, the term was, you know, it wasn't very specific. It was somewhat vague. So it's kind of hard to define exactly what is and isn't a nootropic necessarily. They work through each of them is its own. A lot of them are drugs, and that is how we'll get into the legality aspect of it in a minute. But they all work through different mechanisms. Some of them are very similar, but a lot of them are different, and each particular one can work through multiple mechanisms of action. For instance, like the racetam class of nootropics. People generally know of them as working through, like acetylcholine, where something like the amphetamine class, would be glutamate, but it's not that simple because there's plenty of amphetamines that also, you know, work through acetylcholine, and there's plenty of racetams that also work through, you know, that have an impact on glutamate levels. So, if we were going to sit down here and say, well, how do these work? We'd literally have to go into each one and go in depth on all the different mechanisms of action, which can get pretty complex, and we'd probably be here for hours and hours. But in terms of legality, because saying they are, a lot of these are, they're not technically like nutritional supplements. They don't meet DSHEA guidelines because they're synthetic. They're not found in nature. They're synthesized in a lab, and a lot of these are sold openly on the market. They're not illegal, but they're definitely what would be considered a gray area of supplementation. And I've, you know, heard, and it seems like the FDA is starting to take a bit of an interest in it. Not as much as they are in things like, you know, DMAA or DMHA right now seems to be the stuff they're really after. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if in the near future they go after the nootropics and try to regulate those in some way. And if that happens, you know, if they follow through with it and it gets done, then we'll lose a whole lot of different compounds off the market that do not meet DSHEA guidelines. So, yeah, you would definitely be correct in stating that they are a gray area of supplementation, similar to like SARMs and, you know, peptides and things like that.
So the big question I have for you, Mike, is are these compounds addictive? Like, basically, if I were to take an enotropic, one of the ones you listed, I love it. I start using it for a couple months. Will I not be able to focus without them after that? Is it something like Adderall where you develop a tolerance to it?
Yeah, well, you can develop tolerance to some things. I'm not going to go so far and say that they're addictive, although there are some compounds that do fall into the nootropic class of drugs because they have characteristics that would define them as such, but they're limited. In terms of, you know, physical dependence, but some of them are more likely to build tolerance than others, like phenylparasitin, for instance. I'm sure you've heard of it. It's a great compound. I love it, but you can build tolerance to that fairly quickly, and you'll find that after just, you know, 2 weeks of use, you know, it's not working anywhere near as well as it did in the beginning. So most people will limit that to 2-3 times a week at the most. And then there's other compounds which would be maybe considered more mild, like some of the choline sources, like even something as simple as choline would be considered a nootropic. And that's, you know, there's, you know, you have some of your more potent ones like CDP choline or alpha GPC, but then you have other cheaper forms as well. Those are something you could take all the time. And for a lot of people, you know, a lower maintenance dose probably would be a good idea because a lot of people don't really have adequate choline levels. So it depends what you're talking about. particular compound. There are some that you can take, and if you take them for too long and you go off, you might feel a little bit of a brain fog for a little while. And there are some of them that can cause problems. You know, if you take them too high of a dose for too long, you can end up with really big issues. You can, I know of a few people that ended up in the hospital because they, I didn't know them personally, but I had spoken with one of them briefly, and one of them I knew through a friend ended up in the hospital because he took way, way too much Sunafurium for too long. And it's a great compound and works really well and supplies a lot of benefits, but not when you take 100 times the recommended dosage, for an extended period of time. So just like any other, just like the PEDs where we need to assess risk and be responsible in our use, it's the same way with really that class of drugs. You just need to know what you're looking at, what you're taking, and then just use it appropriately. Some of them cause very little to no problems, like choline, for instance. And then you get into instances where they could cause bigger issues if you're stupid about how you're using them. So not trying to answer the question generally, but it's just that each compound comes with its different sets of risks and benefits in terms of, dependence, tolerance, side effects, all that stuff.
So Mike, simplify for our listeners. This is something I'm interested in, something I'm looking into more too, because like I said, I'm in academia. So if I could take something, at night that would help me focus, it's not going to be addictive and it's not going to affect my sleep. That would be awesome. So what in your opinion are maybe like the three or four best enotropics that you feel are fairly safe and are effective?
All right. Best, how about instead of referring to it as best, because I guess best would depend on what you're trying to achieve. So best would be meaning different things to different people. But if you're trying to use something to, now some of them can keep you up at night. For instance, some of the like medicinal pro drugs, for instance, can definitely, they're lumped in with that class of drugs, but they can definitely keep you awake if you take them because they convert to modafinil in the body. But most of them are not going to really keep you awake per se. If you stack a bunch of them together, you could notice a negative impact on your sleep. So they're not completely benign in that sense, because a lot of them do stimulate you, not your nervous system, but they will stimulate your brain. So you might feel as if you can't shut your brain off. I'm sure, most people have had experiences with that where they lay down and they say, man, I just can't turn on, my body's tired, but I just can't turn my brain off. That can happen, but if you're really tired and you're just, you're ready to go to sleep, generally it's not an issue. It's not going to keep you wired like caffeine would or DMMA would or something like that. So in terms of best, this really comes down to personal opinion. Some of my more favorite ones are, well, let me start with the basic foundation. A lot of the nootropics are going to be choline dependent because they will require choline because they increase acetylcholine production. You're going to need some extra choline to help them work to the best of their ability. Otherwise, you're just going to like burn out your choline stores. You're going to deplete them and you could end up something like headaches and you're not going to be able to get full benefits from the drug. So a good solid choline source, it doesn't necessarily have to be one of the more expensive ones like CDP choline or alpha GPC. They're good. If somebody wants to take one of those, great, go for it. But if somebody's on a tighter budget, you can still get by with one of the cheaper sources and just take a little bit more of it. And it will do its job as far as supplying the body with adequate choline to help potentiate the effects of the other nootropics that you're taking. So that would probably be a good place to start just to, cover your bases so you can benefit from the other drugs fully. Once you go there, then it really comes down to personal opinion. There's a lot of people that will say they love NuPEPT. I personally didn't like it that much. I love Sunafurium. I think it's great stuff. Mildly stimulating, but I've never had a problem sleeping on it. I don't know anybody else that's had a problem sleeping on it either. It's very effective. It's pretty potent. It's even more potent than NuPEPT, and it's fairly new. It's actually been around a long time, but in terms of hitting the market, it's really only been around a few years now. You don't need much of it either. Between 2 to 10 milligrams really is about all it's going to take. That stuff works very well. Now, phenylparasitin, if you take too much, you could possibly have issues sleeping with that. So that really comes down to personal response. Personally, I've never had a problem with it. I know plenty of other people that haven't, but there's some that do. So if you can get away with taking something like that, you know, at night, it doesn't last that long. So, you know, you need to try that out for yourself and see. But I think phenylpyrazine is great stuff. Sunafarin is great stuff. Solid choline source is a base. And then from there, you know, there's a lot of different racetam drugs outside of phenylpyrazine, but I really think phenyl takes the cake on that one. The other ones can supply their own unique benefits. But in general, I don't think anything are going to be as potent or as well-rounded as phenylpyrazine. Uniferum is another good one. It's similar to sunafarum, but it's a little bit less stimulating. So that might be a better choice for somebody like you at night if you happen to have a problem with it. But it supplies a lot of the same benefits, very potent, and works really well. After that, it really just depends on what effects you're trying to achieve and how you respond personally. If you look at a lot of these different nootropic stats, you see people out there, you know, if you go online and you're researching what other people are taking, you'll see that the majority of them are all different, even people that are trying to achieve a lot of the same things, just because each one doesn't necessarily work for the other individual. Now, one thing about the nootropic class of drugs that I want to point out, and why some people are turned off to them, is there are a lot of them that don't seem like they do a whole lot, or their effects are almost imperceptible, you know, versus something like, you know, you take a steroid and you can tell it's doing something right away. Well, a lot, or you take something like modafinil, you know, which would be closer to the same thing. And, you know, you're going to feel that. You take a high enough dose of moda, you're certainly going to feel it. You're going to know you took something, and it's undeniable. But a lot of the other weaker nootropics that are out there don't have a very profound effect. It's minor. So most of them, honestly, I won't use. I just don't see a need for them. So I tend to gravitate towards the stronger ones that have definite, I can definitely discern that it's having an effect on me, and I can tell you exactly what it is and how it's working, versus saying, do I feel this? If I sit down and take something and I ever have to say to myself, is this actually doing anything? Then, in my opinion, unless you're taking it for a health reason, it's a waste of money. If you can't tell if it's doing anything, why are you taking it? So, Mike, but there's got to be. I would go ahead.
That was a crazy amount of info. I'm sure both me and Steve are kind of just like, "Whoa, that was a lot to take in." For our listeners,
yeah, just cut me off if I talk to you. Just cut me off if I'm talking.
No, it's great. It's great info. This is going to be an episode our listeners are going to want to listen to a couple times to try to take that all in. What I was asking is, part of the problem I'm having, you know, researching these compounds is that there's not really a good source of information. You know, I've been on PubMed, and there really isn't much human clinical studies done because they are so new. Do you recommend, right, is there like a source where people can read up on these compounds more? Like, where did you find all this information from?
All the information I found, aside from personal experimentation, all on the internet. And now you can find a variety of different studies on the internet. Like you said, a lot of these don't have human clinical trials behind them because they've just never been used. Some do. You know, some of these drugs come from Russia, stuff like Nupept and some other ones. You know, so you can, if you can find a document that's been translated in English, which they do exist out there, you can find them, you know, and there's some other ones that were produced in Europe. You can also find that literature. There's a few that are made in the U.S., obviously, when it comes to something like, I keep referencing modafinil because so many people know what it is. Plenty of research out there on that one that you can look up. But when it comes to most of them, the majority, no, they're not going to be able to, like, go on PubMed and pull up any, like, human trials. You might be able to pull up some information on them, you know, regarding what they are and their proposed mechanism of action and some animal studies. So you can learn a lot of information there that will help. But really, if you're starting your research and somebody's trying to really find out what they are, you just have to do what everybody else does. You got to look for as many studies as you can. You got to look for as many people that have written articles. And if you read enough, if you go over and pour over enough studies and pour over enough articles, and you gain the personal experience and you talk to enough other people that have used them, you'll be able to start, separating the wheat from the chaff. And you'll know what's true and what's not. So in part of the reason you might find that individuals will report different things on some of these compounds isn't because they're lying or that they don't know what they're talking about. It's that it's affecting them differently than it affects the other individual that maybe wrote an article on it. I hear that with sunafarim a lot. You know, you might see somebody say, this is the best one I've ever used. I love this stuff. And the other guy says, I hate that. You know, it didn't work, but they just didn't like the effects it provided for them. And I've seen people say they love NuPept, and I've seen other people say NuPept did nothing for me. I felt nothing. So, Mike, a lot of it comes down to personal experience.
I got two questions for you quick. Have you written articles on inotropics, and where can we find those?
Yeah, you know what? I've kind of gotten out of writing over the last year and a half. And just when I was starting to get into this class of drugs and do more research on it, it's pretty much when I stopped putting out a lot of articles. And the reason for that is because of the supplement company. It's taken a lot of time out of my day. So even in terms of coaching, you know, I've cut my clients way, way back. I've probably taken on 10% of what I was doing before. So I have not written any articles on them. I mean, I may have included some little bits of information here and there in the midst of, you know, a greater article talking about other things, but nothing specifically on them since then. So it's probably been a year and a half, probably, since I wrote my last article, I think. So it's been a while now, guys.
So the follow-up question then is, do you have like a place you could steer our listeners to look for quality articles, or is it kind of just, you know, Google and see what comes up?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I haven't like saved any, you know, bookmarked any articles. I will just read through until I read enough and try to line them up with what the different studies are saying and see which ones are accurate. And then, like I said, through personal experience, but I couldn't really say off the top of my head, you know, like, here's this article, here's the name, go look it up. I really just recommend people go out there and you just have to dig, you know, you have to dig through the stuff. It's not, I don't think there's really an authority on it, you know, because so many of these compounds have not been used in human beings. How is there going to be an authority if you can't cite any scientific research to say this is exactly what it's doing and the exact effects it's having in, you know, numerous clinical studies? Then it really just comes down to what people are saying in terms of how it affected them. So I'm gonna ask
one more question, and then I'll let Steve ask any questions he has, and then I'm gonna close up the show. So, Mike, I think part of the issue that, you know, we're running into with, you know, someone saying, hey, I tried this inotropic, I loved it, and then person B saying, you know, I tried the same inotropic and noticed nothing, is with gray area supplements, you know, things like inotropics, SARMs, peptides, so much product on the market is fake. So what I personally think is that person who said, hey, I tried this thing and got nothing out of it, in my opinion, they probably got a fake product or an underdose product. So I was going to ask you is, for our listeners, you know, 99% who are looking to use an inotropic, they're basically looking for something that they can take in the evening because either they train late at night, either, you know, they're like me, they're doing some sort of work, schoolwork, something like that late at night. They want something to help increase focus but won't affect sleep. Is there a product or a couple different inotropics that you could recommend our listeners to experiment with who are looking for something like that? And then after you answer that question, I'll let Steve ask any questions he has.
Okay, yeah, no problem. Yeah, really put me on the spot there with that one. In terms of, here's what I'll say. I'll make it easy. Well, first, let me tell you this. In terms of individual products that maybe some supplement companies make, there a lot more companies now are starting, as you know, starting to include them in their products. A lot of them are like more holistic products, like you might find them in a pre-workout that also has stimulants or whatever. There are still some other companies that are coming out with like purely nootropic-based products, but it is more difficult to find, you know, blends, nootropic blends that don't have some type of stimulant in them. At the minimum, most will have at least caffeine or something like that. So when it comes to which ones you can use, really, they are nothing like regular central nervous system stimulants in terms of how they're going to affect your sleep. The only ones I would really say stay away from if you're trying to go to bed would be modafinil or any of its prodrugs. Or any derivative of it, because those will keep you awake. That's their purpose, you know, their wakefulness. drugs. So you don't want to take those because you may find yourself laying in bed for many hours unable to fall asleep. But in terms of any of the other ones, a lot of people can take just about any of them and still have an okay time sleeping. Like I said, some of it comes down to personal response, but it's not going to be anything like, even if you take ones that maybe some people have issues with, it's not going to be anything like, drinking a double espresso or taking, 25 milligrams of DMAA. It's nothing like that. So I would say most people probably are not going to have an issue unless they either start taking really high doses or stacking a bunch of them together in high dosages. So that's about the best I can tell you, because I'm not really aware of any other supplement companies out there that produce just a straight nootropic product that doesn't have some type of stimulant. To be honest, I haven't really looked. And any of the products that I make, they're not necessarily nighttime formulas. I have one product that includes nootropics, but it's in daytime. I have another product that is a nighttime product, but it doesn't, the compound it contains, thionepine, is, some people define it as a nootropic and others don't. And the reason that is because, like I said earlier, it does have some nootropic properties. So technically you could say this drug has nootropic effects, but at the same time, it has a whole bunch of other effects that aren't normally associated with nootropics. But that is a completely different type of product. It's not like something somebody would normally use to study with or anything like that. So I wish I could answer your question better for you, buddy. But
tell me a little bit more about that nighttime product you developed. What exactly is that for? Is that to help you sleep or?
Well, I don't recommend it as a sleep aid. And the reason for that is you shouldn't be taking it every day. If you take it every day, you could develop a physical dependence to it. Now, it is unlikely because I have added compounds to it that are going to reduce the possibility of that occurring. And because it has a relatively short active life, it's not like it stays active for 24 hours or something like that. It's not going to stay active in your system for that long. So the chances of having any type of physical dependence is going to be low. But what it basically is, it's a thionepine product with different potentiators added to it and anti-dependence compounds added to it. And essentially what thionepine is for those people listening that aren't aware, is it has a variety of effects in the body, but one of them is, here's what people use it for. It's good for pain. It's also good for increasing. It's basically an opioid-like drug. It's a full opioid agonist, just like something like oxycodone, hydrocodone, morphine. Same type of mechanism of action, attaches right on the opioid receptor and activates it. So you're going to get all the same effects that you would get from that you're going to from, taking a Vicodin, for instance, or a Percocet or something like that. The difference between this product and those, traditional prescription opioid agonists is that thionepine is not going to cause a decrease in physical performance. And it's actually been studied and has been shown to not decrease physical performance, unlike traditional opioids, which kind of make you just, want to lay on the couch or whatever else. Now, if you take too much thionepine, you take a lot of it, yeah, you might just want to lay down and not do anything. But it's very unique. It's the only compound in its class. So there are no other drugs like it. If there was something else I could compare it to and say, here's this, and that, this is similar, just a different drug in the class, but there aren't. It's very unique, stands alone. So it also has a bunch of other benefits on cognitive function. And it's great for pain reliever. I find a lot of people using it, guys, they're in pain at night, have training-related injuries. Some people use it during the day. At the same point, some people will just take the non-PM version, which has some, wakefulness drugs in it. And a lot of people use that before training because they say, this is the first time I've been able to train without pain. I feel great. My mood's great. And, they love it. So the PM version is essentially, it doesn't have any of those stimulants in it. So you could definitely use it and go to bed, take it at night. It's not going to negatively impact your sleep at all. If anything, it will just help your sleep, just like a regular opioid would. But it won't knock you out. Like I said before, it's something that isn't going to turn your mind off or negatively impact your ability to exercise or train or engage in any other type of physical activities.
Steve, do you have any last questions?
I'm just curious how much do these things cost and how easy are they to get?
Very easy to get. I mean, there's so many companies out there today selling these things, and most of them are cheap, honestly. Some of them, you know, may cost more than others, depending on what you're buying. You know, some of the more expensive ones would be modafinil and its analogs. Those are a bit more costly. And something, you know, like something like alpha GPC or CDP choline is kind of expensive for a choline source. You know, if you're taking a higher dose of that, you might spend some money. But generally, most of these are sold in singular form. You don't really find a bunch of blends with different ones. You will just find, like, you can buy this one, that one separately, all by themselves. And the cost is usually pretty reasonable, but they're usually in powdered form too, you know, so you have to measure it out, you know, make sure you have a scale, because, you know, a lot of these things, they're dosed in such small amounts. You know, if you're trying to take 10 milligrams of something and you've just got a little thing of powder that comes in the mail, sorry, but you can't just take a spoon and, you know, just that looks about right. No, you can't do that. You can end up taking 100 times more than you're supposed to and end up having some problems. So you really do have to have a microgram scale, so you can get very accurate with it. But you need to have a scale, at least a milligram scale at the minimum, so that you can, you can weigh your stuff out. But yeah, it's easy to get, and they're fairly inexpensive. Unless you start, you know, buying several of them and stacking them together, then the cost could start to rise.
Mike, this was a really interesting show, especially the enotropic section. I mean, wow, that was a lot of information to take in. This is definitely an episode that I myself am going to listen to a couple times. What is your supplement website, Mike? I'll let you give that a quick plug, because I'm actually pretty interested in that product you're talking about. Can you say the name one more time? That's like an opioid, but it won't affect your ability.
Yeah, there's two of them. The first one that we came out with was called Vicaine, and that was a combination. It's an opioid stimulant complex. So just as the name sounds, it provides those effects. It would be similar to taking an opioid and a stimulant together. But unlike most stimulant products on the market, it doesn't contain, you know, DMAA or any of the other strong central nervous system stimulants. It contains only a small amount of caffeine, because I wanted to stay away from that I'm shaking, I feel geeked out type of feeling, anxiety. I didn't want that in any of my products. I wanted people to be able to focus, be awake, have energy, and improve all aspects of their cognitive function without feeling overstimulated, which some people love, that, you know, that really powerful stimulation feel, and other people don't use pre-workout products because they hate it. So the original product, Vicaine, is an opioid stimulant complex. The other one is called Vicaine PM. Essentially, I named it that just because I took out all the stimulants, I increased the dose of the opioid compound, and added potentiators and anti-tolerance compounds to it. So, and that would just be called Vicaine PM. And both of those are found on the website, which is masups.com. And I'm telling you guys, if you are unfamiliar with any of these compounds or these type of products, I know we read this stuff, all what I'm about to say. You see it in like every supplement ad, you know, all over the place. You always see people saying, oh, this supplement breakthrough of that last decade or whatever else. I mean, everybody's trying to make their products sound like they're something new and radical and amazing. But you will not find any other products in the entire fitness bodybuilding industry like those. There is nothing like it. And when I've made the comparisons before to people that have said, you know, this is like taking a Vicodin, dude, be careful, you know, don't take a whole bunch extra or whatever else, gauge its effects on you first. They don't believe me. You know, say, I can't tell you, there's been hundreds of people that have said, you know, I just thought it was just a bunch of hype, you know, just trying to sell supplements. No, that's not what's going on here. When I write my descriptions, if somebody reads them, what you read in the description is accurate. So they're very, very strong products, and they do exactly what they say they're going to do. So, pretty interesting stuff. I'm pretty proud of those products, actually.
Interesting. Well, Mike, we really appreciate you coming on. Once again, I just want to give a big congratulations to Boston Lloyd and Ariella on getting pregnant.
Yes.
I'm trying to convince them that if it's a boy, they need to name it Trevor, but I'm still working on it. I believe the boy name they have picked out right now is Jackson, but you never know. Trevor's another good name. For your host, Trevor Caritzen, for my co-host, Steve Smee, and for our special guest, Mike Arnold, this has been another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life, look good doing it. Thanks for listening.